What was an amazing thing about it was being in an environment where you have other kids your age who are also interested in this pretty niche and somewhat strange thing, but they're also like really into it. Because, you know, growing up, like you wouldn't run into a whole lot of people who were like that into classical music, or maybe anybody, like maybe a handful of kids, maybe in your youth orchestra or something, but like you're not going to be getting together and pulling out all sorts of different recordings. You're like really getting into, oh my goodness, let's compare all these different, you know, Chacones with like from Heifetz to Kramer to, you know, all these like people really, really into that kind of stuff. And being in that environment, again, being exposed to kids who played other instruments who are really, really, really into it, you know, you learn so much stuff because of the enthusiasm of your peers.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This weekly series features a fascinating diversity of musicians worldwide. Today's guest is violinist Jeremy Mastrangelo, who's a colleague of mine in Canada's National Arts Centre Orchestra. He's known in our green room as a wonderful storyteller, on stage as an excellent musician, and having heard him give brilliant masterclasses, I can attest to his excellence as an educator as well. This episode is infused with Jeremy's wit and wisdom, as well as a couple of beautiful violin performances. We talk about his mentors, interesting professional junctures, family support, and sources of inspiration from books, travel, and food. Like all my episodes, this is available on your favorite podcast player, a video on YouTube, and everything is linked in the show notes to my website, leahroseman.com. Hey, Jeremy, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me, Leah.
For those of you who are new to the podcast, once in a while I invite my colleagues in the NAC Orchestra, and it's really fun to get to know people in this different way. You know, I get to prepare and think about the questions I'm going to ask rather than just having a coffee break together. I thought it'd be interesting to start with the fact that your brother, Dave Mastrangelo, must have been both an influence and an inspiration, because I, you know, not everyone has an older sibling who plays the same instrument than them. And also, I'd love to start with music soon in the episode. So very soon, we're going to be sharing a very special piece of music that he arranged. So do you want to speak about what that was like growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. And, you know, I'd have to say, I think my first violin influence had to have been my brother Dave, because he, you know, he's about 8 years older or so. And so I was just sort of surrounded and exposed to a lot of violin music from a very young age. I started asking my parents for a violin from the time I was three. Mm-hmm. There was something about the instrument I loved. My dad is a pianist, played like jazz piano a lot, but also learned all the classical repertoire so he could accompany us growing up. But yeah, my first violin influence was Dave. So, I mean, I was exposed to so much music that was so much more advanced and ahead of where I was. I mean, I think, you know, to be exposed to things like the Isai Ballade from a fairly young age, to be able to fall in love with a piece that, you know, for a kid is a little bit more out there, I think was amazing. So, you know, I'm sort of hearing this all the time. I really wanted to play a violin, and I started to ask my parents for one when I was fairly young, but they thought that, you know, I wasn't ready to handle it yet. And there was one point, I don't know if it was before I was going into like JK or maybe kindergarten or something. My mom comes home one day from shopping, and she's like, she's really excited. She's like, "Hey, do you know what I got you when I was out shopping?" And I'm like, "A violin?" She's like, "A book bag, like for school." And she was really excited. And I think, I don't know if that's the thing that sort of like got them thinking, you know, hey, this kid really, I mean, he's been pestering us for like years now. So, you know, finally I had to wait what felt like an eternity. And at that point would have been twice the number of years I'd been alive, you know, when I was six. You know, my parents, the deal was they were going to go rent me a violin for a year. That meant that I had a 1 year commitment. So they were not going to pay for this thing and waste their money. Like, we're doing this for, we're going to try it out for a year. At the end of a year, you can quit. They rented an instrument from a local place. And I remember it was just like the most incredible thing to open up the case, just like the smells, all those things that are still, you know, there, but that we sort of take for granted now, is all so new. And as soon as I had to actually like practice the thing, I really quickly tired of it and just wanted to quit. But it was that, you know, year commitment thing that sort of got me roped in. And you know, having starting right off the bat with weekly lessons with the same teacher that Dave had, that's what sort of got me going.
Mm-hmm. Did he help you practice at all?
No. I will tell you one funny story. And Dave is a really, really great guy. Big heart. But he is also a sibling and, you know, an older brother. And, starting out, you know, mostly I would play, you know, I think like most kids starting out, kind of by ear. Like you'd be taught something, but it'd be mostly you're imitating your teacher or whatever. I mean, I hit scales and stuff like that, but there's not like a lot of very heavy duty, like, you know, reading of music. So Dave, at a certain point, I don't know how long I'd been playing. I could not have been more than maybe 7 or 8 or something. And so he says, hey, let's do the Bach double together. And so he hands me a piece of music. He goes upstairs to practice and he leaves me, you know, down in the basement or in a place to practice. And I'm looking at this. I had never seen a piece of music that wasn't in G major. So all of a sudden I'm looking at this thing. I can't even figure out what it means. And like, he comes down like half an hour later. He's like, so you're ready to go? And I think I just started crying. And because I had no idea what was going on. And I talked to him about this like years later, like much, much more recently. And he's like, yeah, I remember that. I said, yeah, I think I wanted you to cry. So, you know, as far as like, you know, practicing together, there was not so much of that. But it was nice once, you know, I got older and, you know, a little bit more competent on the violin. Then we could actually do things together. And one of the things that I still think is the most fun is when we can get together on occasion and do like, you know, like a little quartet gig together or just, you know, some duos or whatever. He's a lot of fun to play with. He's just a very fun guy to be around. So we have a ball when we get together. And there's really, I can honestly say this, there's never been really like a competitive type of thing with us. He was always so much older that there wasn't really an issue. And there was only one time where we took the same audition together. And even that was sort of like, hey, you know, we both understand how hard this is and we're just going to support each other and help each other out. So I've been very, very fortunate.
Yeah. Well, you brought up auditions, which was on my mind. I'm on a lot of committees this year, so I'm going to be listening to a lot of auditions. And I was thinking that maybe you've had a lot of resilience training, and we'll get into the more particulars of the, you know, your education. But I was wondering if you had advice for people with regard to that, if you know what I mean by resilience
training. Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. Honestly, I feel like the circumstances of my upbringing, I think, were sort of resilience training in and of themselves. I mean, three brothers and, you know, kind of like a high energy household where people would just get on you for anything. And I think something like that is just sort of, I don't know, I never really thought about like resilience training or anything specifically for things like the audition process, but it's definitely something I think anybody can learn and kind of adapt a bit and just sort of have a different type of outlook. But I think for me, maybe some of it was just survival growing up, and some of those things have actually had maybe a practical application in my life, which, you know, again, maybe a sort of a hidden blessing of, you know, growing up with three people that are, you know, all smarter, more talented, and whatever, and you just have to kind of figure out how to bounce back a little bit. Mm. But it's definitely, you know, like as far as outlook goes, I mean, I think now that, you know, I think about these things more, you can like sort of codify it and put it into, I don't know, like strategies to implement as far as you're looking at, you know, setbacks and things like that as, you know, there all these experiences are learning opportunities, things that you can grow from and, you know, build on and, you know, hopefully, you know, kind of have this type of progress in your life that also will apply to something, to specific situations like an audition scenario. But I think they're just good kind of life lessons.
Okay. Well, I want to dig into this more with you, but I think It'd be really nice for people to hear this beautiful, beautiful arrangement that Dave made of Bach's Goldberg Variations theme. So if you want to speak to that a little bit and before we play the video.
I'll tell you just very, very briefly about it, and then maybe we can talk a little about it afterward. But this was a pandemic project, and I'll just throw this out there that he did the entire Goldberg Variations, which I'll just leave it at that. Maybe we should listen to it, and then I can talk a little bit more to it afterward.
This is Jeremy Mastrangelo performing the aria from J.S. Bach's Goldberg Variations, arranged by Dave Mastrangelo.
That was so beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing
that. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks. I love it. So
can I buy Dave's arrangement of the entire Goldberg Variations?
Yes, Dave has somewhere you can purchase, I think, just portions or the entire set of variations. It was a project that came out during the pandemic. And, I think all of us obviously found ourselves with a lot more time on our hands. And there's limits to, how much Netflix or whatever that, anybody can do. So Dave, I had no idea he was planning to do this. All of a sudden he sends me like a PDF of just like the aria and maybe like the first few variations. He's like, I'm working on this. I want to do the entire Goldberg variations. And I was just sort of stunned and I started going through it. And the aria is so well known and it stands so well by itself, which is really, really nice. The whole set, I'll be totally honest with you, is really, really hard. Like I one night I was just like, I'm just gonna slog through this thing. And it's like going through the A minor fugue, but for like an hour. Like it is that hard. Like it's really, really challenging. So, anybody who wants to tackle that, I think that would be like an unbelievable project for somebody, with more talent and or time. But it's fantastic. And Dave, you can...
I'll link that in the show notes of this episode. I'll link to Dave Mastrangelo's arrangements. And he also composes a little bit, or mostly arrangements?
I think mostly arrangements. I don't know if he... That's a good question. I don't know if he has original compositions. I know he does a number of arrangements for solo violin that he's done. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in terms of auditions, we were talking about before. Now, not everyone listening will be familiar with the blind audition process for orchestras. Do you want to speak to that?
Sure.
And your feelings about it?
Yeah. Decades and decades ago, I mean, the audition process was less formalized than what we have now. It was could be often something as simple as you get maybe a verbal recommendation, you know, word of mouth to a conductor, you go play for a conductor in their hotel room, they hire you for a job, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, it wasn't always like that, but that was one method that, of auditioning candidates, bringing people in. It was often, you know, people we know, people we like, so on and so forth. Orchestras were predominantly male up until the 1970s. And the first time that screens were finally started to be introduced, widespread in the industry, is an effort to eliminate bias. Almost overnight, it became about 50-50 male-female. And over the years, the process has become even more anonymized. So when I tell even violin students about some of the procedural things that take place to guarantee anonymity, they're sort of surprised, like the fact that you walk out on stage and you aren't walking on just the regular flooring. It's there's a carpet that's typically put out so nobody can hear footsteps, maybe able to identify or pick up anything about a person. In the past, like various orchestras have run it where maybe the first round is screened or the first two rounds are screened, or some orchestras used to have or have had all rounds screened, and that's kind of the direction orchestras are moving in, and that's the way the NEC is going with our auditions, that every round is now screened. So completely anonymous, and it's again in an effort to reduce as much bias as possible and really focus on the playing. And I think it's about as fair a process that you can kind of come up with for trying to find candidates. And you look at an orchestra like the Met, which has for a very long time had a completely anonymous, fully screened process, and it's hard to argue with the results. The other side of the coin is also, and I have to mention this, that the more salary that's offered, like in any industry, typically the more talented people are going to be attracted to it, so that also helps. But again, the process itself, making it as anonymous as possible, I think has benefited the industry.
Yeah, and actually I was going to bring up the Met, because as far as I know, they're the only orchestra I've heard of where they have to hire at the end of the day.
Yes.
That's unusual.
With the exception of principal positions, but yes, at the end of a day of a series of rounds, they have to hire somebody, which is unusual. And I'm not sure how many other orchestras do that, because one of the things that happens quite often is an audition is held and a committee says, nobody was good enough, so we didn't hire anybody today. And that's, not uncommon for that to happen. And, it's up to every orchestra, I guess it's their prerogative, what they're looking for, whatever. I could see both sides of it. I could see where there's a benefit to like saying, hey, look, make a decision already. You got to find somebody here. Because there can be sometimes a tendency to maybe overthink and, get into the issue of, I don't want to have buyer's remorse, kind of thing. I'm not sure. I don't know if I feel terribly strongly about that aspect of it, but it's interesting. It's another element.
Now, you've been involved for some years on bargaining committee and orchestra committee, as we call it in our orchestra, dealing with collective agreements. Do you want to speak to that, like your feelings about the importance of participating in that process?
Yeah. It's something I was completely unfamiliar with, like in school. And even, I spent a year at New World, and it's just not something, because that group is not unionized. It's just something I was unfamiliar with. I started my first job in Syracuse, and all of a sudden people are talking about this collective agreement, a contract, and it's all completely new for me. I think the value of having something like this, is it creates the parameters by which we function within this organization. So, the collective agreement is designed to help, protect employees, if you want to describe it as labor and management, however you want to look at it, to protect employees from possible, abuses that can happen. I mean, I'm not saying anything that's, I think, controversial. I think anytime, instances of abuse tend to happen where there's a power imbalance. And when you have an employee-employee relationship, obviously that relationship is inherently unbalanced in favor of the employer. So it's, a lot of it is designed to protect employees and also to articulate their responsibilities in this arrangement as well, and just provide the parameters in which we work. I think it's very important for orchestras, not just in terms of salary, but like working conditions, to work towards conditions. And this, every industry is going to have industry-specific needs. For musicians, obviously, there's issues with time off or like physical ailments for like the things that we deal with. As our bodies deteriorate and everything else, we experience a lot of the same injuries that athletes experience, and having this understood by management, the employer, is really important. It's something I never did at my old job. I had no committee experience. That was sort of handled by people who did that kind of thing, and like I actually didn't have much interest. I was the musician's representative to the board for a number of years, which is a different type of thing and has its own, that was also very, very interesting. But it wasn't until I got here to the NAC, and it was mostly because I think at the time there just weren't many people who wanted to do it. So somebody asked me like, hey, would you do it? And I always feel like if there's something that's like, yeah, this thing has to get done, nobody else really wants to do it at this time, so yeah, sure, I'll give it a go. And it was the same thing when I did the board rep stuff in Syracuse. I remember the guy who had done it for many years, who was terrific, he's our principal trumpet, and one day he's like, Jeremy, would you be interested in doing this? I was like, no, I have no interest in doing this. But I'm looking around and I'm like, okay, I've been here for a few years. If I don't do it, who am I expecting to do this? Like, my colleagues have been doing this for like 30 years. I eventually, I felt like, okay, I gotta pitch in and help out a little bit. And so that's sort of how I got involved on the orchestra committee at the NAC. Is, I should, it's something new, something different, try it out.
Well, on a previous guest of this series is Anna Peterson, who was also your colleague in Syracuse. So in that episode, she's an oboe player. We talked a lot about yoga, which she's really involved with, and also when Syracuse folded and she had to find work. And I know your experience was different than hers. For one thing, you had kids. Your wife, Sarah, was also playing in the orchestra.
Yeah, it was a very, very difficult time. It was sort of the lead up to when the orchestra shut down. Was it was like watching the slowest train wreck ever sort of unfold. Sarah actually had gotten onto the orchestra committee in 2010. We had just signed a contract, supposed to be for like 3 years. It was the first time she'd ever been on any committee, and a month into her time there, the orchestra management came to the orchestra committee and said, we have to renegotiate the contract because we don't have any money and we're just going to have to shut things down. Like, and it really blindsided everybody. They had just signed an agreement. We had no idea what was going on. So Sarah somehow, like near miraculously, kind of took us through a renegotiation, which that orchestra had never done. It was a very, I'd say, kind of an old school kind of union management relationship there, and not one given to much flexibility. And she somehow managed to bring these sides together and buy us a little bit of extra time. I won't even get into all the details. There's a lot of crazy stuff. But at the end of that year, she'd only been on for about a year or so. She came home from a meeting with the management, and she says to me, I think that they're going to shut down the orchestra, and I need to go get another job because we're not going to have health care. Because, you know, if you lose your job in the States, you have no health care. And that week, she went out, she took an interview with an insurance company, she got a different job, she quit the orchestra. This is like December of 2010. 4 or 5 months later, in April, the orchestra shuts down, and everybody's like, I didn't see this coming, nobody, blah, all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, Sarah saw it coming, like the handwriting was on the wall. She saw it, as soon as she recognized it, she got out. And then when the orchestra shut down, I mean, she said to me, she's like, so here's how we're going to do this. I'm going to be working this insurance job so that we have, you know, healthcare for the family. And you're going to go out and try to get every possible gig you can and help, you know, provide for us. And that's how we're going to get through this. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was incredible. You know, it's interesting that, you know, some people have that ability. They see, they're like, it's not a question of, you know, the question of if has already been, you know, settled. It's now a question of when. But then to act on it is something I think is harder for people to do than you know, you might think. So you see it coming, but it's almost like you're paralyzed. All you know is this one thing. And she just, you know, got out pretty much immediately. It was really, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty miserable job, I understand, too.
It was challenging. It was very challenging. I mean, she was working on, like, straight commission, you know, life insurance for a while. And what's tough is when, you know, like, how these things work is you start with your personal network, right? So you got to start calling your friends and family to sell them insurance. And when some of her very, very close friends, like, stopped returning her calls, like, that's tough. It's very, very tough. So she was fortunate. There was a guy that she worked with who was outstanding, who needed an assistant. And so she ended up becoming his assistant and helping him out because she's great at, like, organizing things and stuff like that. So it helped make the job more, you know, I should say less painful personally and professionally. So, I mean, as much as we deal with rejection with auditions, when you're in sales, it's like, it's even worse. It is tough. It's a tough job.
Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media, and share my posts. And if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing, and you can find that link in the show notes. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode.
Now, I find it interesting. I think you're the only violinist I've ever spoken to who's played so many different roles in the orchestras you've played in. Like, you've probably sat in every chair in both sections. A lot of concertmaster experience, a lot of principal second experience.
Yeah, it's I feel very, very fortunate because I mean, for the first, you know, 10 years of my career, I was associate concertmaster in Syracuse. So it was mostly like in the second chair in that orchestra and would play, you know, concertmaster a bit. I had some, you know, concertmaster experience from like some summer orchestras, a little bit of principal second in some summer jobs. And then, you know, I started subbing with the NAC, kind of filling in for a bit as principal second. And then I've sat with every colleague that I've had at the NAC except for Lev. But I sat close to Lev.
Yeah.
But I've literally sat with everyone and everywhere, like front, back, both sections. I was really pleased a few years ago. I completed my personal double Beethoven cycle for having done all 9 symphonies, both violin parts, which was pretty cool. And I enjoy the variety. I like, you know, getting to sit with, you know, a lot of different people. And I can genuinely say, like, I enjoy, like, all my colleagues. It's really, it might be unusual from talking to other people in other orchestras, like, like really like everybody. And it's like, yeah, all these people are wonderful to sit with. They're great colleagues. They're fun. And I enjoy it. So yeah, it's different, but I like it.
So I'm interested. You actually keep track of which symphonies you like. I don't keep track of things, you know.
Oh, well, you know, when you've done like all nine, it's I think that's pretty memorable. And it helped. I think when I finished it was when we did like a Beethoven cycle a couple years ago. I was playing second violin. We did all nine like in 2 weeks or something.
Yeah.
So that one, I knocked that off really quickly. It's sort of in the back of my mind, like which ones I've played.
Mm-hmm. If we could go back to your musical education, it interests me. Now, a previous guest of the series, Leslie DeChazor, Detroit-based violist and violinist. So she went to Interlochen with the summer program, and I remember discussing with her this whole thing about, you know, having a competition for the chair and encouraging this among the kids, which really I find off-putting. But you went to the residential school during the year for high school.
Well yeah, I went to the year-round academy, an arts boarding school. I also did do the summer camp for a couple mm-hmm. years and went through, you know, yeah, like the weekly, what did they call them?
Challenge or something?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, the orchestra challenges, which it's funny, like even as a kid, the value of it that I recognized was that I didn't see how you could do the rep that we did every single week and get the kids to prepare it well enough without mm-hmm. this. So I sort of saw this like secondary benefit to it. It's, well, actually it's maybe a primary benefit is to ensure that everybody's practicing their music. And like, how else are you going to do it? Like in the summer, it's like, gosh, I could go swimming where I could practice. And it's sort of like, well, I've got this weekly challenge. I should probably be practicing. But yeah, I did attend the academy for 2 years, which was a fantastic experience. It's a year-round arts boarding school in northern Michigan. And that's what was really, what was an amazing thing about it was being in an environment where you have other kids your age who are also interested in this pretty niche and somewhat strange thing. But they're also like really into it. Because, you know, growing up, like you wouldn't run into a whole lot of people who were like that into classical music, or maybe anybody, like maybe a handful of kids, maybe in your youth orchestra or something. But like, you're not going to be getting together and like pulling out all sorts of different recordings. You're like really getting into, oh my goodness, let's compare all these different, you know, Chaconnes with like, from Heifetz to Kramer to, you know, all these, like, people really, really into that kind of stuff. And being in that environment, again, being exposed to kids who played other instruments who are really, really, really into it, you know, you learn so much stuff because of the enthusiasm of your peers. Mm-hmm. You get to know, like, you know, Schumann's song cycles and things like that, because you know somebody who's a singer is like, oh my goodness, you've got to listen to this guy, Fritz Wunderlich. He's like amazing. And you're like, I've never heard of this person. And you put on the CD and you get to just share that enthusiasm. And being in an environment like that, I think was really invaluable as far as kind of setting me on this path. I mean, my parents told me years later, you know, they said, we figured we'd send you out there and that was either going to be the end of it, like, yeah, this is not for me, or you'd really take to it and know that this is what you wanted to do. So,
yeah, I think you were very fortunate. I don't think there's too many programs like that. I haven't heard of many.
Actually, I'm not even sure if I can name like another one, really. Like, CIM has like a young artist program with like high school students. But you're in like a university setting, and I mean, it's in that way kind of similar, but this thing where it's just like, it is just, you know, high school kids mm-hmm. doing this kind of thing. It's a very special place.
Yeah. Now this will be a wonderful place to share the other recording you've shared with us. And I remember when this was posted, this Piazzolla Etude. And I right away ordered the music because I wanted to play it. And it took, because it was the pandemic. Do you remember the mail was just messed up? You couldn't get packages?
Everything was messed up. Nothing was working. Yeah.
Yeah, so this music got lost, and I ordered another one, and I ended up, I think, with two copies after 8 months. So I did finally learn this etude and taught it and a couple others. So can you speak to when you first heard this piece?
Yes, because I remember exactly the first time I heard this one. I was at University of Michigan for grad school, and Gidon Kremer was traveling. He was touring with St. Petersburg Symphony Orchestra. He was playing Shostakovich. It's one that nobody does. It's the second concerto, I think, is the one that is not done. And he finishes. It's brilliant. And he comes out and he plays this encore. And I'm like, oh my goodness, what is this thing? Like, I knew I could pick it out as Piazzolla, but I had no clue what it was. So a friend of mine I was sitting with, I was like, what is this thing? And he knew immediately. He's like, oh, it's one of the Piazzolla flute etudes. And I was like, who knew? So yeah, I went out and ordered the music right away as well.
This next piece of music is Jeremy's performance of the Tango Etude No. 3 by Astor Piazzolla.
Thanks so much for sharing this. A really great performance.
Oh, thank you, Leia. Thanks. It's something I really love. I've read through all of them. It's that third is probably my favorite out of the bunch. I mean, they're all terrific. They all have different characteristics and everything. But I'm also just kind of a big Piazzolla fan. So
yeah. Now, when you were making those recordings, we were locked down, we weren't playing in public. It must have had an eerie similarity as to when your job in Syracuse shut down, in that you didn't know what the future would bring.
To an extent, I actually, it's interesting, I did not really draw that connection so much with Syracuse. I was incredibly fortunate that literally kind of out of the blue, work just started kind of materializing that I, you know, had no idea about. I did a lot of soliciting as well for work, you know, sending out my resume to places and making inquiries, and literally nothing from any of my inquiries led to any work. It was, well, the first bit of work that I had, which was really out of the blue, like a couple days, maybe the day after orchestra shut down, I get contacted by the Omaha Symphony Orchestra. And there was a guy there, an oboe player that I had known from like a summer festival from previous years. He'd been sort of monitoring. No, it was a clarinetist. He'd been sort of keeping tabs on, he'd been seeing what was going on in Syracuse. They shut down and I get a call from their management. They're like, hey, do you want to come in and do some work? And I was like, yes. Yes, please. So in that way, it was a little bit different because I was both like untethered, but also had like very fortunately like a lot of work. The pandemic was very different because I had like a job, but no work, which was strange. And at the time, I was doing orchestra committee and. We went into like three times a week meetings with the NEC administration to do what exactly, you know, because there's nothing to do. Like, I don't know, but we were in a lot of meetings. It was just, I found the pandemic actually much more eerie. When our orchestra in Syracuse shut down, it was more just like a half terrifying, half like exhilarating, just new experience type of thing. The pandemic was just sort of like, oh my goodness, what's going on? What do we do? Like, how long is this going to last? I mean, that was like a major question. I found this thing somewhat recently when the pandemic hit. Because you know, people were talking like, yeah, it's going to be the schools shut down for a couple weeks. So I wrote out for the kids. I was like, hey, I've got a plan. Here's things we can do for the next 3 weeks. Right. And it was like, we're going to go on a hike. We're going to do these things. And I look back, I found this thing like much, much later. I was like, oh my goodness, if we had any idea, it's probably best that I didn't have any idea what was coming. And I think a lot of people maybe didn't, which in hindsight, I think is probably good. Probably helped me stay a little bit more, you know, mentally together.
When you got kind of parachuted in by Pinchas Zuckerman was our music director at the time to play principal second. What was that like meeting him for the first time, working with him?
It was incredible. I'll be honest with you. Like, to me, it still feels like when I think about it, like it was like being thrown a life preserver when you're like drowning in the ocean. So I'd had, you know, a certain amount of work lined up and the work was starting to come to an end. And I had like summer work lined up, but nothing, you know, really immediately. So I get an email one day. It was from Nelson McDougall, who at the time was a personnel manager. And it just starts out and it says, hi, my name is, you know, Pinchas Zuckerman mentioned that maybe you would want to do some work. And I'm like, what? Like, I've never met the guy. I've actually never even, like, been to a concert of his. I've never, like, crossed paths with this person. Why on earth would he have any idea, you know, what's going on here or whatever. And it felt like the kind of thing, like, you know, you read like the, you know, stories, you know, like in like the Bible about like you find this thing like on the ground, you have no food, you wake up, there's this thing and it's like, where'd this come from? What is it? I don't even know. I'm just glad it's here. And so I started coming here. Actually, no, I have to clarify this. The first time Nelson emailed me, I had some sort of concert in Syracuse. I said, you know, sorry, I can't do it. And then he got in touch with me again. And I think I told him the same thing the second time. The third time, I was like, you know what? I'd better take this or else it may not happen again. And all I had to do, I had to work out getting out of like a single concert, which, you know, was granted. And I came up and I played 1 week and it was like, oh my goodness, it was one of the most exhilarating musical experiences I think in my life. Still stands out in my mind. It was a week that Hannu Lintu was here conducting, and it was just incredible. I called my wife. I was like, I had no idea this place existed. This was like unbelievable. And she's like, well, yeah, she's like, it's a great orchestra. How come you didn't know that? I was like, I didn't know. So I mean, the whole way I ended up kind of coming here was, I just feel incredibly fortunate to have been introduced to the orchestra that way, and to you know, get to work with Pincus and get to know this orchestra before, you know, I ever took an audition or anything here.
Mm-hmm. What are your feelings about, for people that have never played in an orchestra? You know, it's kind of like an organism. You know, when it's great, it's amazing the communication we can have.
Yeah, it's I feel like the best orchestral experiences are the closest to chamber music experiences, mm-hmm. where there's that communication and understanding with your peers and your colleagues. It's something that you can have great orchestras where there's not necessarily that level of communication and connection. I mean, you can have great players who don't necessarily, you know, make this effort to do this. And it's the thing that I love about this orchestra is that it really does feel so much like a chamber type of environment where there's a lot more kind of personal interaction, a lot of communication that happens. I remember when I was at Interlochen for high school, we had two orchestras. We had the regular big orchestra, then we had the string orchestra. And the string orchestra was run by the viola professor, David Holland. And his goal was to not be involved at all in the end as far as like conducting the orchestra. So what it got to at the end is like we'd be in performances and he would just walk off the stage and just leave and we would just keep going. And like in rehearsals, like he would just make sure, like, are you paying attention to what the basses are doing? Like, are you watching the bow and matching like the concertmaster? So all these things that it was eye-opening that orchestra could be like a quartet, which I always, that's what I always loved was doing chamber music much more, you know, than orchestra when I was younger. And it was the first time I'd experienced something like that. And other than maybe, you know, a couple of very special like summer orchestras that we did for a number of years, I think it's hard to find that sometimes with professional groups, but you do find it at times, and it's really, it's so exciting, you know, when the orchestra has that that type of connection and has that kind of feeling of intimacy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're known for your pithy and witty comments in rehearsals and on breaks, and one of them I remember you saying is, there's times when no one should be looking at the conductor.
Yeah, it does sound like something I'd probably say. Yeah, there's, you know, I mean, this is not a slam on conductors or anything, but this is just sort of a reality of, you know, how orchestras kind of work best at times. And understanding, you know, what the role of the conductor is, and then what the role of the orchestra is, the responsibility that the orchestra has for maintaining ensemble and stuff like that, regardless of, what's happening on the podium. Like things like ensemble are our responsibility. Mm-hmm. You can't, you know, the conductor doing this, if the conductor goes like this and everybody plays with what they see at the same time, it will sound a mess because, you know, light travels at a different speed than sound. So mm-hmm. you go like this, everybody plays when they see it and their sound develops and happens at different times and the ensemble's just horrendous. So making the ensemble work is the responsibility of the orchestra. The conductor is there to provide, you know, interpretive ideas, tempo ideas, you know, phrasing, you know, things like that, balance issues, all those kind of things. But the ensemble work is the responsibility of the orchestra. A couple years ago, I heard there's a guy I went to school with for a couple years at CIM, Frank Huang, who's now concertmaster of the New York Phil, and he made a comment in an interview to exactly that same point. He said, look, he said, it doesn't matter who's up there conducting. Like, we have a responsibility to, we will sound great and we will play together all the time because we're the New York Philharmonic and that's our job, you know. And then, like I said, the conductor's there to provide other things, but the conductor's not there primarily to make sure it's together, right? It's just, the physics don't allow it to happen. So, you know.
Now, you're married to a violinist, as am I, which can be wonderfully supportive, I think. And it might be interesting to talk about things like, you know, you have some of your family background is Italian, and I know you've traveled there a little bit to Italy, and you went to Cremona with Sarah when you were younger. What was that experience about going to the birthplace of violin?
It was very, very cool, and not just for the violin aspect of it. There's actually this thing, and this sort of, it still kind of blows my mind when I think about it. So growing up as a kid, yeah, my dad's side of the family is Italian background, and you know, his relatives, my grandmother, I never met my grandfather, unfortunately. He passed long before I was born, but we would go visit my grandmother, you know, a couple times a year, and always at Christmas time. And my grandmother, every year, you'd get the same gift. You'd get a thing of socks, you'd get a soap on a rope, and you would get torrone candy. So it's this little nougat candy that has almonds in it. And as a kid, I would read on the back of the box how this candy was invented in Cremona. And it was supposed to resemble this big clock tower in the city. And this is something from my childhood that I'd completely hadn't thought about it in ages. And Sarah and I made a first trip to Italy in 2004. And we were going to go to Cremona to meet this violin maker that had been recommended by a friend because Sarah was looking for an instrument. And I remember we're driving into Cremona and I see this clock tower, and all of a sudden this flood of memories and like connection to this thing, this candy that I'd had as a kid from my grandmother. And then like, then you see that they sell it in Cremona, of course, and this is the birthplace of this candy. So I mean, even more so than like the violin thing, the first thing that hit me was this kind of, you know, this buried memory of this connection with my grandmother, which was pretty neat. But there's still the violin maker that we both now play his instruments, Vittorio Villa. He made a crack. There's still like over 100 violin makers that live in Cremona, and he insists because it's a cheap place to live and because violin makers tend to be kind of frugal. So he said, yeah, there's still a lot of violin makers here, but, you know, not necessarily because of the history. It's just because, you know, they're very practical. But it is it's a small, beautiful city. There's great shots in the film The Red Violin of Cremona, and you see the clock tower there, and on, I forget if it's like a, you know, certain days of the week, there's like a market that they set up, you know, in front of the clock tower and sort of like a piazza there. And there's opening shots in the film that are shot there. And it's a really, it's just a beautiful, beautiful city. The history is so rich. And, you know, violin making in itself is such an interesting art form with a lot of mystique to it, a lot that's still not quite understood. And I find things like that fascinating and alluring.
Yeah, and I'll disappoint listeners who haven't heard my episode with Teo Marx, a violin maker and connection with many people we know. Really interesting episode. So you said Sarah was going to buy a violin from Villa, but you ended up buying one. Was it at the same trip?
No. So actually, what happened was Sarah, you know, she goes, we try out the violins, and so she commissions an instrument, but she's not sure if she wants the Stradivarius copy that he makes or the Guarneri copy that he makes. Mm-hmm. So he says, you know what, I'll send them both to you. Pick out pick which one you'd like, the one you prefer, and sell the other one. And we're like, okay.
So the instruments show up. She prefers the Guarneri copy. And then we have this Strad copy, which then sat in our house for years because, like, it's just not the easiest thing. Like, if you don't have, like, an infrastructure and a network mm-hmm. to go selling instruments, like, we tried for a little bit. But, you know, somebody sends you an email. They're like, yeah, I want to try the violin. Can you ship it to me, like, across the country? And it's like, how do I know I'm ever going to see this thing again? Like, it's very, I find the whole thing, the business aspect of it, kind of perplexing. So it was just sitting, you know, in our house for a few years. And I had reached a point where I was just looking to try something different. And I was like, funnily enough, we have a violin sitting in the house collecting dust. So maybe I should dust it off and see what it sounds like. And so I started playing on it, and it has certain qualities that I find really attractive. There's a real, I think, sweetness to the sound. There's other things I find, you know, I'd love maybe a little bit more someday, you know, if I get a different violin. But I've been happy with it. It matches Sarah's, obviously, very, very well. So when we play together, like, there's no issues there. Mm-hmm. Same violin maker.
Yeah, and you put together some lovely duo videos with her, which I'll point people to as well. They can listen to those. So let's go back to your violin education. You studied with a couple of very well-known teachers.
Yes. I was very fortunate, well, first of all, to have had, oh goodness, I mean, from the very beginning, my first violin teacher. And if you don't mind, I mean, I won't go down the rabbit hole too much, but I mean, just like, very sort of an interesting, my background with my teachers. My very first violin teacher was the one my brother Dave studied with. His name was Rafael Sobolevsky. He was an immigrant from Russia. He left the Soviet Union in the kind of late, kind of maybe mid-1970s, and had been sort of an up-and-coming soloist there who was, you know, being sort of trotted all around Europe, you know, as, you know, like any number of soloists were, you know, by that government. And he ends up moving to New York City. He has a small studio in Syracuse. He taught for a little while at the university. So he was my first violin teacher for 7 years. It's who, you know, I got started with. And I'll circle back to him because there's a really interesting story that ties in with the pandemic and sort of a crazy, crazy connection. But I studied with him for about 7 years, so till I was like 13. And then he said, you know what, I'm not going to be making this drive anymore to Syracuse every week. He told my parents, you know, you need to drive down to New York every weekend for lessons. Now, you know, my dad, who, you know, vocationally or for you know, professionally, he sold radiology equipment. He was on the road all the time. You've got four kids. Like, you're not driving down to New York City every weekend for violin lessons. So all of a sudden we're without a teacher. You know, my parents were a little bit, you know, were sort of like, gee, what are we going to do? And at the time, Dave was at, I think he was in school. He was at SMU down in Dallas. And he calls up one day and he's like, hey, you know, I just heard that there's this guy, he plays in Atlanta Symphony now. He's coming up to Eastman School, which is in Rochester, you know, like an hour from us in Syracuse. And he's going to be playing with the Cleveland Quartet. He's supposed to be pretty good. His name's Bill Prusel. You know, maybe you can get lessons with him. My mom, being, you know, the kind of mom she is, she's, you know, there's always like these sort of like great quality, like it's the flip side of like a personality type, right? So my mom is just a person who can just like, she just like goes whole hog into things, you know, and she can just be like very, she can just go from like, from nothing to like 100, like instantly, just one of these mm-hmm. people, like, kind of amazing that way, just like a wonderful, wonderful energy. And so, and just like a real kind of boldness. So, you know, Bill moves to Rochester that summer. She calls, this is back in the days before, you know, obviously internet and looking people up. She calls Rochester Information. She gets his home phone number and she calls him up, because this is what moms do. And she's like, hey, you know, Mr. Prusel, I've got this kid. Could you give him some lessons? And he's like, oh, you know, I don't really teach, you know, high school kids. You know, my schedule, I'm touring a lot. The lessons aren't regular. She's like, you know, look, can we just come play for you and just make a decision after that. And he said, okay, sure. So we go to his house in Rochester. My dad is accompanying me, play for him and everything. And, you know, it ends up working out that, you know, he took me for 2 years in high school. And then he's the one that encouraged me to go to Interlochen because he said, look, if you're going to study with me as an undergrad, I want you to have a break. So it's not like 4 years of me, then another 4 years of me. So 2 years and then a break, and then you can study with me for undergrad. And the thing, it's funny, my dad always talks about this. We're in this guy's house. We still have no idea, like, his reputation or really anything about him. And my dad said he's looking at his CD collection, and he notices that in his CD collection are recordings of him. And that's when my dad is like, maybe this guy's pretty good. You know, like, again, we had no idea. We're just looking for a teacher. He was unquestionably, I think, probably the biggest musical influence on me in terms of, you know, I think there's something of such great value, especially at a young age, to get a certain sound in your ears. Mm-hmm. Like you, and for the longest time, I could pick out on any recording, it's like hearing a parent's voice. I could, you know, easily pick him out of a lineup of 100 violinists, and just something about the sound that, and I think, especially then, I think was really like just this, it's still to my ears, one of the most beautiful violin sounds I've ever heard, in a way of getting around the instrument that also lent itself to this type of, I'd say like a vocal quality in his playing. But I was also, when I went to Interlochen, I had great teachers there. My teacher my second year was this guy, Hal Grossman, who still was like a huge influence on me in terms of like understanding how to start to approach Bach and like interpreting Bach. Like, you know, you're a kid, you open up something like the G minor Adagio, and it just looks like a whole mess of notes. It's like, I don't know where to even start with this thing. It's just like, it's chords, it's notes that look really fast, but they're not really fast. Like, how does this make any sense? And he was great at, and very influential for me for as far as like being able to take a look at this thing on the page and make some sense out of it, understand the structure, how to phrase, looking for various lines to give you direction and stuff like that. So, you know, I had him for a couple, for a year in high school. And then for grad school, when it came to that time, I remember talking to Bill and asking him about if I could study with him for a grad degree. And he said, you know, at this point, he's like, you've studied with me long enough that you kind of know what I'm going to say before I say it. He said, I think it's time for you to move on. So he had a couple recommendations for teachers. And so I ended up at University of Michigan with Paul Cantor, who's just a great, great guy. And that's where I also met Sarah. So if for nothing else, I'll be honest with you, the education was in some ways kind of secondary to the fact that I was, you know, fortunate enough to meet Sarah there. And just the environment at Michigan was also one that very, very different from like the small conservatory type of environment of Cleveland, a much bigger school. You're on a even if when you're on like the campus that has the music school, the campus itself much bigger, and then you're just part of a like a major university, which was a lot of fun. So it was a nice way to sort of finish up my education. And at that point, I was like, man, there's no way I could get another degree because I'm so done with school. Like it's time to move on. So it worked out.
Now your first teacher, what was his name? Sobolevsky?
Yeah, Rafael Sobolevsky. And
Sobolevsky.
Thank you. If you don't mind me sharing the story, because this sort of blew my mind. He's somebody that, again, I stopped studying with him when I was about 13 and then completely lost touch with him. My brother Dave actually lived with him for a couple years in New York when Dave was in grad school there at Manus, studying with Sally Thomas, which remind me to circle back to that because there's a connection there that I want to talk about that I find funny. But so I completely lost touch with him. And then at a certain point, I'm like, gosh, you know, I wonder if I could ever reconnect with him, find him or anything. And then I find out that he'd passed, maybe it was like 2012 or something. And I sort of unfortunately missed the chance to kind of reconnect with my first violin teacher. Then in the middle of the pandemic, 2021, And again, just like kind of out of the blue, I get an email one day, and it's this lady in New York, and she's telling me how a friend of hers just purchased an apartment in New York, and it had belonged to this guy, Rafael Sobolewski, and there were still items in the apartment that they were just looking to get rid of. And so she did a Google search to see if she could find any students of his who might be interested in any of these items.
Wow.
And she found my name through something and looked me up. And so she gets in touch with me. And I was like, well, like, what do you have? You know, and she said, well, I've got like some framed items. I've got some records, but, you know, the writing's all in Russian. And I was just like, you know what? Yeah, I said, send me the prints. Send me the records, and there were like a couple like little like bookends, just like mementos, right? So this stuff, like the getting it here from New York, was in itself kind of a nuisance and everything. But what fascinated me was, so these records show up, and we had only just purchased a record player sort of randomly, because my daughter had gotten into picking up some records as like decorative items on the wall. And I was like, well, you know, you've got these great records. It'd be nice to actually listen to them. So we bought like a record player at like the Shoppers Drug Mart. It's like just something, you know, just sitting, one of those random things. You can buy like a PlayStation there and you get record players. So I put this thing on. And again, it's all like Cyrillic. I can't read it or anything. I start listening. And the first record I listened to was the Bach, the C major solo sonata. Mm-hmm. And I'm listening like, oh my gosh, it's like an old record. Like the playing is phenomenal. And I'm listening and like, it's not, like, because you get familiar with some of the old recordings. I said, it's not Milstein. It's not, but it's of that era. Mm-hmm. But the playing, it's like super clean. It's just different. And I start to think, you know, is it possible that this is Raphael, mm-hmm. you know, recording of him? So the first thing I did was, I've got a cousin who worked for a number of years as a journalist for the AP in Russia. So he's fluent. And so I take a picture and I send him a picture of the record label. I was like, hey, can you just tell me what this thing is? And then as I'm waiting to hear back from him, I'm like, wait a second, there's like ways of figuring this out nowadays. So, you know, get Google Translate. Mm-hmm. And when I got the thing, when I load it up and when I first see that, yes, it reads it and says Rafael Sobolewski playing on these records, and it just floored me, because I never heard the guy like in his prime. Like, by the time he moved to the US, there were all sorts of issues, and sort of he made reference and allusion to how he had to emigrate, which was very, very challenging. He managed first to get out by going to Israel, because at the time the Soviet government was allowing some people to leave, first to go to Israel, and then he came to the U.S. But the whole story about how he left was, you know, it was very dramatic. Like, he reached a point where he knew he was being watched by the KGB, because they were suspicious that he might want to try to defect. There were issues with his career. By the time he, you know, got to the U.S., his playing was not what it had been. And so, you know, there were always these things about, like, you know, Raphael, he's a bit of a hacker, you know, like, who knows if he was ever, like, really that good. Mm-hmm. And then there's these records, and I'm listening, like, oh my goodness, like, he was not only good, he was, like, a first-rate talent. And, like, listening to these recordings, like, he was, I think at the time, I figured it out, maybe in his early to mid-20s, he'd done, like, Queen Elizabeth competition and things like that. Mm-hmm. And to hear somebody of just exceptional talent at their peak with the type of confidence, knowing how good they are and just reveling in their ability, it is something that's so special. These recordings are just the energy is so visceral, and yet the playing is so refined. It's this incredible blend of, like, yeah, just like power but refinement. And so there's the Bach, there's a series of Shostakovich short pieces, there's the Tartini Devil's Trill Sonata, which he always told my brother was one of the pieces he was well known for in the Soviet Union. And it was just like a treasure trove of amazing recordings. That for me, it was incredible, like, as an adult and a professional, to get a window into what he was like when he was younger. And then I'm thinking, oh my goodness, and this poor guy had to come and, you know, basically just kind of like teach a bunch of little snot kids, you know. He goes from being like this brilliant soloist. I was like, I wonder what that might have been like for him. So yeah, it was just a really kind of neat thing that happened over the pandemic, and this connection I had with my first teacher.
Well, that woman who contacted you, who went to that trouble, kudos to her. That's wonderful.
Yes. She found this stuff and she felt like, we can't just throw it out. I'm going to at least see if there's any student of his around that I can track down who might be interested. So yeah, I was just very fortunate that she took the time to do it.
Now, you wanted me to remind you about the connection with Sally Thomas and your brother.
Yes, yeah. So there are a couple funny stories about that, because my brother, I think it was maybe right before he was going to go study with her at Manus, he spent a summer at Metamount studying with her there. So Dave goes away to Metamount. I went away to Interlochen for the summer. I was like 14 or something. He comes home, and all he can do is rave about this young kid he met, this violinist, this brilliant kid from Canada, mm-hmm. right? And I'm like, you know, Dave, I'm pretty good too. Like, how brilliant are we talking, really, you know? So he had this cassette tape from the summer, and it's James Ennis, who was at the time, I think he was 15 or something, and he does some concert at Metamount, and it's Bazzini, The Dance of the Goblins, and Bartok's Solo Sonata. So, like, the Bazzini is one thing. Like, it's a virtuoso, brilliant piece. You could probably find, you know, a number of kids who could, you know, navigate it, you know, and maybe even well. Bartok's Solo Sonata is unusual for, like, a kid that age. That's the thing that's, like, a little bit like, okay, we're dealing with somebody a little bit different. And I listen to this thing, and even with, you know, sort of an inflated sort of adolescent ego, I listen to this thing and I'm like, this guy's like, he's at it like at another level. And so my brother Dave gets to, you know James initially from meeting him at Metamount when James was like a kid. And I actually came across, again, as one of these pandemic days, I have this box of these old cassette tapes with just random recordings. I found this this recording of James from that summer, and I had a bunch of stuff put on CD, and I listened to this thing, and I was like, it's actually more impressive to me now than it was back then. Mm-hmm. But that's how Dave got introduced to James. And just one funny aside, it's just a story of Dave's. I don't think he'd mind if I mentioned this one, but he was talking about a lesson once with Sally Thomas, and he was working on some Bach, and he had, you know, the kind of the international edition that I think a lot of us have worked off at some point. And he brings it in for a lesson, and, you know, he's worked out his own kind of bowings and fingerings, and, you know, Miss Thomas just says to him, you know, Dave, I'm just curious, you know, there's, you know, bowings and fingerings in the part, any reason you're not using those? And he said, well, yeah, he's like, I just don't think they're very good. You know, he's like, I like this stuff better. And he said that she got really upset about this, like in a way that sort of surprised him. And so he, you know, goes like home or something that day, and he's talking to a friend of his, and he's like, you know, Miss Thomas had this sort of weird, like, reaction when I told her how much I didn't like these bowings. And he's like, well, Dave, have you ever read the dedication at the front of the book? He's like, no. So he opens up the international edition. It was edited by, you know, Ivan Galamian, and at the bottom of the page it says it's like an acknowledgement of Sally Thomas, who worked so closely with him in editing this part. So Dave's sitting there completely unknowingly insulting the edition that his teacher had made of the Bach. So you know, but that's how Dave is. Very, you know, he'll just tell you what he thinks. So
yeah. I James Ennis is a previous guest of this podcast, so he talked about Sally Thomas quite a bit. And actually, also, Tracy Silverman had studied with Galamian. And I won't give away the story, but he tells a story with relation to playing Bach for him in his first lesson that relates to this, actually. we talked about your trip to Italy and violins. I know you're really into cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, are you a recipe user or more off the cuff?
You know what? I definitely started out as like a recipe user, and I've gotten to the point now where like if there's something new I want to try, I'll look up like five versions of the same thing and sort of like figure out what I think I'm going to like and sort of mishmash them. And now I sort of look at recipes as sort of like a guideline to sort of mess around, because I've got a decent idea of like what I like and how I like things seasoned and different things, you know, that I think that will work for me. But I'm always, you know, curious to try new stuff, and I like cooking all sorts of different types of cuisine. So I've put together like in our spice rack like a tandoori spice mix for when I'm doing like, you know, Indian food. I've got like a Jamaican spice mix for when I'm doing, you know, like Jamaican food and Caribbean food, and like any number of things. I'm always curious to try new things, different types of cuisine, and I kind of like all of it. I'm not just omnivorous in terms of, you know, types of food, but just like regions and you know, different cultures of food. I like all of it. So, yeah, it was one of the interesting things years ago. One of the more unique tours that the orchestra took was to the Northern Territories, and you know, among other things, it's always interesting to try different cuisine in places where you've never been. So, you know, trying like whale blubber, you know, stuff like that, or raw caribou, like all these things, I'm usually game to try just about anything. So,
and in terms of keeping inspiration and balance in your life, I know you read a lot of books about music and composers. Are there a couple of titles you'd recommend to people?
Absolutely, yeah. And essentially, you mentioned that, like I do like reading a lot of stuff, and I've found more recently I've been reading more nonfiction than fiction. And some of the fiction I've been reading, I've been going back and sort of actually rereading stuff. But two that three that I love are one is of Brahms, who's my favorite composer. It's by Jan Swofford. It's called Johannes Brahms. Very simple, and I'll tell you a little bit more of that in a second. The other one, which is outstanding, is Christoph Wolff, Bach, The Learned Musician, which I actually just repurchased. I read it the first time on Kindle. Now, like, the books that I had on Kindle, I'm rebuying, like, as books, because I just like, you know, paper better. Mm-hmm. That's a great, great book, and really gives you a window into Bach as a person in a way that, you know, I know, and I find PDQ Bach, like his satirical stuff, you know, humorous. He has one like sort of kind of poking fun at like a lot of the correspondence that we have of Bach's, which was a lot of very dry correspondence with like the town council about like, hey, you need to pay me, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, but this actually gives you real insight into who he was as a person. And there's also a great biography of Mozart's by Maynard Solomon, another really good one to read. But the Brahms one, before Swofford, one of my brothers, back in like the 90s, because he knew how much I love Brahms, he bought me this biography, which was probably one of the better ones at the time. But the thing with Brahms, he got rid of so many traces of like his personal life, burned lots of letters, he destroyed, you know, so many copies of music that he didn't think were good. So he left as little as possible. So my younger brother, and it was really very sweet of him to do this for me one year for Christmas, buys me this biography. And the thing is, because there's so little, you'd get like a biographical chapter, then like an analytical chapter, which I find very dull. So like it was kind of a tough slog. And then Swofford writes this biography kind of, I don't know if it was like late 90s, early 2000s or something, which much, much richer in terms of just like the personal biographical stuff. And I absolutely, it's a fantastic biography. I'd recommend it to anybody who likes Brahms at all. But really, really just well written, very insightful. I've also read, I found this in a library years ago, The Letters Between Brahms and Clara Schumann, which is really also very, very interesting to read, because it gives you a really firsthand window into their relationship that
you know, people can write about their relationship, but you read the letters and you really get a sense of how intimate they were, and just in terms of their like affection for each other, you know, and even if you want to maybe take somewhat, you know, put in the context of the type of language people used to address each other at this time in history, mm-hmm. in Germany, you know, all that aside, it's still like incredibly, the like I said, the level of affection between the two of them is remarkable from, you know, throughout their entire lives. And they had such an interesting relationship. You know, Brahms would sometimes kind of help watch her kids when she was out like touring, stuff like that. She would like invest his money. So they had this kind of funny, almost like a, in some ways, like a, like the way some spouses kind of look out for each other. They had, to some extent, that level of closeness with each other. But yeah, Jan Swafford's biography I'd recommend to anybody, and the other two as well.
Yeah, we recently had this wonderful Brahms, Robert Schumann and Clara Schumann festival, which I thought was really well done. Yeah. And we got to play the Brahms double concerto with James Ennis on violin and Nicholas Alstadt on cello. And that's one of the pieces you've performed as a soloist.
Yes, that was one I did in Syracuse with a good friend of mine, wonderful, wonderful cellist, David Ledoux, who's now in Detroit Symphony. When Syracuse shut down, he very quickly started taking auditions and got a job in Detroit. I love the piece. I love the kind of the history of the piece. It's written as something of a, almost like a peace offering, or like a reconciliation sort of gesture with Joachim from Brahms. I was just very, very fortunate that, you know, the music director of Syracuse at the time, Daniel Hege, who's a terrific, terrific guy who really was so very supportive of me when I was first starting out with my career. And, you know, it makes a big difference, you know, when somebody puts, you know, a lot of confidence in you to do something like that. So that it was meaningful for me that way also. And, you know, getting to put together a piece like that with like a brilliant, brilliant colleague, it was just so rewarding. I do remember, you know, for me, and it's something I remind myself of when we have soloists visiting, how difficult playing a concerto with an orchestra is. I call it sort of like going into the tunnel for a little while. Like for a certain period of time, like this is the thing that sort of like dominates your thought and your recreation and like your waking, resting moments. Like it's this thing that, at least for me, it was, you know, anytime I've had like a concerto performance with an orchestra, it becomes like this thing that really kind of takes over for a while. I remember starting to have like those bad dreams, you know, because we were playing it like towards the beginning of our season, like around October or so. And I remember in the summer at one point having one of these dreams where I'm at the first rehearsal and I'm like, oh my goodness, I've been practicing so slowly, I never got to the third movement. And like, I've got to play it like this week. What's going to happen? So, you know, there is that element of it also that goes along with playing concertos. And it's something that I really admire about soloists. It's not just the playing. There is so much more that goes into that life than just getting around the fiddle and stuff like that. There's all the things of like living your life as somebody on the road, playing in any number of different places, having huge amounts of repertoire that everybody expects you to have flawlessly. And, mm-hmm. you know, when I've played concertos, it's like, it's the one thing I've got coming up and I'll spend like months super focused on it. And that's hard enough. So it's a remarkable thing, I think, that soloists do. And I've been fortunate to have, you know, a few opportunities to get to do it, get a taste of it, experience the parts of it that are amazing, and be thankful when it's done. Mm-hmm.
So just, we were saying that was a bad dream you had where you weren't far enough along in your preparation.
Yeah. It's one of those preparation dreams where like, yeah, I think a lot of people who are maybe tend to be conscientious have these dreams of like, you know, like, yeah, the test that you forgot to study for, or, you know, whatever. And I remember I started having those dreams in the summer before like I was even close to having rehearsals. Like just,
I always have these dreams, of course, and we always used to start
that does not season. Surprise me, by the way.
We used to start our season with opera in September after our August break. And one of the recurring dreams I would have is that I was expected to be on stage singing, of course, in Italian or something, with no rehearsal. And like, here's your dress and go. Yeah. And other many variations on those dreams. Do you have other variations of that stress dream?
I have like the classroom dream, which, and I should be careful saying this because my daughter is at university now, but I wasn't always the most diligent attender of all my classes. So I would occasionally actually have that situation happen, like when I was an undergrad, where I might have missed like a unit of, say, something in like sociology, and you show up and it's like, oh yeah, there's a quiz on this thing that like I hadn't been at classes. So I still sometimes will have like class related dreams, preparation things, but that's also somewhat rooted in like a reality of my past. So I don't know how much is like, yeah, like a conscientious thing and how much is like, no, this actually happened to me.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, with your love of history and music history, do you think in an alternative life you might have done that, written books, done research, biographies?
I think it's something I would probably really enjoy. The little bit of stuff I've done in terms of writing, like about music for, you know, just like kind of random little things. You know, years ago, like when in Syracuse, wrote a thing for like the local paper about like life as a musician, or I've written like program notes to various concerts I've done at different times, or just talking to students about the history of pieces that they're learning, because I find mm-hmm. I find it just gives so much more richness to the music. It's one of those things like, do you hear it when somebody plays it? I don't know, but I think it definitely makes it more meaningful for the performer when you understand the context of you know, when pieces were written, what the composer was going through, what they were like as a person. Like, I still find, like, certain things, you know, I think about Schumann sonata, like the A minor sonata. And, you know, there's, in that second movement, which I love, there is this really, it's going along, and probably not even in the right key. And it's a really kind of easygoing, you're just sort of like, you're walking, you know, out in the sunshine and everything, and there's like this turn all of a sudden, and it gets it's like a cloud sort of comes over the music. And, you know, I have to think that like somebody like Schumann, with his kind of well known you know, struggles with mental health and everything, if this somehow sort of like connected with like something he would have experienced in his own life, where like all of a sudden things are going great and then it's like a cloud and you can't even do anything about it. It's just something that kind of happens to you, and then you're going through this next phase that's like much, much different, and like, how do you get out of it, right? And I think understanding you know, composers, their lives and stuff like that, I think it just adds a richness, and if nothing else, kind of helps you enjoy maybe the preparation and the practice more than just like, okay, I've got to play this in tune, I've got to have a good sound, you know, the very kind of dry mechanical things that we spend a lot of time, you know, having to deal with because of the nature of the instrument. But I think it gives, yeah, more depth to the music.
Beautifully said. Well, on that note, I'm going to thank you for today.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being on the podcast.
I appreciate your time very much, Leia. And could I have time for like one more just quick story?
Absolutely.
It's something that I've never told you this, and I actually feel like this would be like the ideal time to mention this. So I talked about my first week here, how much it sort of, you know, floored me, you know, playing with this group. There was something I remember very distinctly that happened that week. We're playing Beethoven's Fifth. I remember at one point, you hear the section, like, Lintu makes some sort of gesture, and, like, all of a sudden, you hear the vibrato of the entire section, like, change, like, as a group. You hear it, and everybody's doing it. Nobody's sticking out. And it occurred to me that, like, wow, like, it's everybody in this group is engaged and focused and, like, really bringing it. And what reinforced that for me was another concert, maybe it was later that season. I remember it was
Carlo Rizzi conducting Sibelius 5. In the end of that first movement, there's this E-flat arpeggio thing in the first line. It's like insane. And I remember like being backstage and hearing somebody practicing this thing, but like not just playing it like how sometimes, you know, well, I'm in a section, it's not super important, but like somebody practicing this thing like this is like a concerto. This person is playing this to go out there and just nail this thing, like getting ready to just like lay it down. And so that was you practicing this thing backstage. And it was, I honestly, I found it very, very inspiring. It's like, so here's somebody who's been doing this for a while, who's playing in the section, who is absolutely bringing it every single day, just completely like, not just playing it so that it's good enough, but like playing it to play it. Like this means something. And I think that type of, that's a really special quality, I think, that this orchestra has. So, you know, I, you know, admire you for that. And I think you're one of the reasons that this orchestra sounds the way it does is, you know, people like you who have that kind of integrity to maintain those types of standards.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. I think I do remember that, learning that lick. Okay, well, I'll see you at work, and hopefully we'll have you back on the podcast later on for a catch-up episode.
Sounds good. Thanks, Leia.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. There's such a fascinating variety to life in music, and this series features wonderful musicians worldwide with in-depth conversations and great music, with over 100 episodes to explore. Many episodes feature guests playing music spontaneously as part of the episode or sharing performances and albums. I hope that the inspiration and connection found in a meaningful creative life, the challenges faced, and the stories from such a diversity of artists will draw you into this weekly series with many topics that will resonate with all listeners. Please share your favorite episodes with your friends and do consider supporting this independent podcast. The link is in the description. Have a great week.